This is the preface to the Derek Jensen Reader. It's, I think, one of the best things I've written. The dominant culture, Western civilization, is driven by a death urge, an urge to control, an urge to violate, an urge to destroy life. Unless it's stopped, it will kill every living being on the planet, every living being it can. 14 years ago, no, it's 14 years ago when I wrote the preface, so 20 years ago now, I wrote what has become one of my most quoted passages. Every morning when I wake up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. Yet I'm not always convinced I'm making the right decision. I've written books and I've been an activist. At the same time, I know neither a lack of words nor a lack of activism kills salmon here in the Northwest. It's the presence of dams. In the time since, things have gotten much worse for salmon and for the world. By now, we all know the numbers, or we should. 200 species per day driven extinct, 90% of the large fish in the oceans extirpated, more than 98% of native forests destroyed, 99% of prairies, and on and on. Every biological indicator is going the wrong direction. Native communities, human and non-human, are under assault. Just where I live, bat populations have collapsed, as have newt populations, butterfly populations, cranefly populations, dragonfly populations, banana slug populations, songbird populations, crow populations have collapsed, bat populations, woolly bear populations, harvestman populations, moth populations, bumblebee and solitary bee populations. And those are just some of those I've noticed. Salmon have continued to collapse. I give salmon 15 years. If we can bring down civilization in 15 or 20 years, I think salmon will be, in time, fine. Much longer and they won't survive. Far too many of us have forgotten, or never knew, the words can be weapons to be used in the service of our communities. Far too many of us have forgotten, or never knew, the words should be used as weapons in the service of our communities. For far too long, too many critics and too many teachers have told us that literature should be apolitical, as though that's possible, and that even nonfiction should be neutral or objective, as though these two are possible. If you want to send a message, they've told us too many times, use Western Union. I once spoke with a nature writer who refused to lend his name to a campaign to protect a species about whom he had written, giving as his reason, "I'm a writer, damn it, I have to remain neutral." When the world's being murdered, such a position is inexcusable and immoral. It's also really boring. Further, it's ignorant of literature's history and of what it means to be a real writer. Have these people never heard of Steinbeck, Dickens, Crane, Hugo, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, Rachel Carson, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Alexander Kollontai, George Eliot, Catherine Burdekin, Zora Neale Hurston, Andrea Dworkin, B. Traubin, Upton Sinclair, a little Tolstoy, anyone? A few years ago, I read a book that, for me, epitomizes the emptiness of the modern movement toward apolitical literature. It was a book called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and was a memoir of someone who had a stroke and lost the ability to voluntarily move any part of his body except to blink one eye. He eventually was able to begin communicating this way, and he wrote a book. I read it because I saw so many reviews calling the book a triumph and an important piece of modern literature. I hated it, though. Primarily because prior to his stroke, the protagonist was a narcissistic, self-pitying, nature and woman-hating asshole. And after the stroke, well, he was a narcissistic, self-pitying, nature and woman-hating asshole. But the failure of that book is not why I mention it here. I mention it because as I was reading it, something kept niggling at me, and finally near the end, I realized what it was. The book has essentially the same plot as Dalton Trumbo's novel, Johnny Got His Gun, which is about a soldier in World War I who wakes up in a hospital and slowly realizes he was hit by a bomb. He's lost his hearing, his vision, his arms, his legs, his face. The only way he can communicate is by tapping his head against the pillow. But in this novel, written some 80 years ago, the character isn't a narcissistic, self-pitying asshole, but rather becomes an anti-war messiah. The book has moved me to tears each time I've read it, and it's one of the most powerful anti-war novels ever written. That trajectory, from Johnny Got His Gun to The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, mirrors for me the degradation of too much modern literature. I will not participate in that degradation. It's long past time we all, writers and readers alike, began working to restore and maintain a literature of justice, resistance, and revolution. I recently received a note from the writer John Keeble, who 20 years ago was my teacher at Eastern Washington University. telling me he'd been following my work. He wrote, "I know you've been writing and that among some circles you're famous," which at once fills me with pride and bemuses me because I know well that nothing matters to you as much as the issues. He's right. And he articulates well my own split feelings about what I have or have not accomplished with my work. I would not be who I am, and I would not write what I write without having learned from some of my elders who did not believe that writers should or can be apolitical. As one writer said to me, we're all holding hands through time, helping to make an unbroken line of resistance. Or as another insisted, the truth is most important. It's more important than money. It's more important than fame. It's more important than your career. It's more important than your preconceptions. Follow the truth. Follow the words and ideas wherever they lead. Yet another said, when you lie to readers, whether this lie is something as small as an incorrect word or as large as a wrong idea, and whether this lie is explicit or by implication, you are stealing from your readers, stealing their time and stealing their hearts and minds. Another said, no matter how you try, you cannot separate art from politics. So-called apolitical art supports the status quo. But the most important thing anyone said to me, and I heard this time and again from those I respected, is this: words matter. Art matters. Literature matters. Words and art and literature can change lives and can change history. Make sure that your words and your art and your literature move people individually and collectively in the right direction, in the direction of justice and sustainability. It is possible to create a literature that is immoral. This is something we see all the time. A literature that supports capitalism is immoral. A literature that supports patriarchy is immoral. A literature that does not resist oppression is immoral. But you do not need to follow in those traditions. You can help to create a literature of morality and resistance, as each new generation must create this literature with the help of all those generations who came before, holding their hands for support, just as those who come after will need to hold yours. I was taught that art can be, and to be moral must be, a combat discipline. If too few of us remember that words can be weapons, even few of us remember that as weapons, words cannot fight alone. Words can help us resist, but by themselves, they do not topple dictators. They do not stop capitalism. They do not stop oppression. They do not halt species extinction. They do not stop global warming. They do not remove dams. At some point, somebody actually has to do something. At some point, someone actually needs to physically destroy the infrastructures that allow dictators to stand, capitalism to metastasize, oppression to continue, species extinction and global warming to accelerate, dams to murder rivers. No one can seriously believe that words alone would have stopped Hitler. Words alone wouldn't even have stopped Ted Bundy. And words alone won't stop the dominant culture from destroying life on Earth. That job is up to all of us. I think often of a question asked by a friend and mentor. What are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you in all the universe? And that's precisely where I've succeeded and precisely where I've failed. There are many ways my writing life could so far be considered a success, far beyond anything I daydreamed when I was younger. I've written 20 books, 25 now. People seem to enjoy reading them and seem to enjoy coming to my talks, both of which honor me beyond belief. Despite the truth of the old cliche about writing, that it's a terrible way to make a living, a great way to make a life, for at least the last few years, I've been able to financially support myself through writing. Although once again, proving the truth of this cliche, I've still never made as much as I would have as a fresh graduate in my first job after finishing the Colorado School of Mines, where I graduated 30 years ago. More important than all of these, however, is that I've been true to my muse, and I've at least attempted to tell the truth as she's presented it to me. And I have at least sometimes succeeded in articulating some of those things I know in my heart to be true, but to which I've not yet put words. And in so doing have, I hope, helped some others to articulate some of those things they may know in their hearts to be true, but to which they have not yet put words. And through all this, I have come to know I am living the life I was born to live, doing what I was born to do. And far more important than all of these, my work is contributing to a literature of morality and resistance, and to the formation of a culture of resistance, and the formation of a militant movement to stop this homicidal culture from killing the planet. That is all to the good. But the fact remains that if we judge my work, or at this point anyone's work, by the most important standard of all, and in fact the only standard that really matters, which is the health of the planet, my work, and everyone else's, is a complete failure. Because the planet is being murdered, and my work hasn't stopped that murder, nor has anyone else's. We haven't even slowed it down. It's embarrassing to have to explain why this is the only standard that really matters, but at this point, embarrassment is the least of our problems. The health of the planet is the only standard that really matters, because with all living planet, nothing else is important because nothing else exists. And also because the extirpation of 200 species per day is profoundly immoral. Compared to this, the number of books out doesn't matter. How beautiful or poorly they're written doesn't matter. Financially supporting oneself doesn't matter. Whether one is doing what one was put here to do doesn't matter. Life itself is more important than what we create. The health of the oceans, the forests, the rivers, the salmon, the sturgeon, the migratory songbirds, all are more important than are you or I individually, and are more important than your or my accomplishments. Their health is the measure of our success. Writing books is generally considered a solitary craft. And there are ways that, at least in my case, this is true. I spend hours, sometimes days, happily alone with questions and threads and themes and words and ideas and emotions and images floating past, sometimes coalescing, sometimes not. I spend hours happily alone asking myself what precisely I'm trying to say, asking my muse what she wants me to say, and for help in saying it, asking trees and rocks and rivers and stars what they want me to say, and for help in saying it, I ask for dreams. But in other ways, writing is not solitary at all. First, it's a collaboration between writer and reader, in the words themselves, as each brings offerings to the communication. And there's that matter of holding hands through time and across species. When I write, not only I am writing, but so are those who came before me. And so are the salmon and moths and bats, and so is the muse. Social change makes no pretense of being solitary. Revolutions and other forms of social change require organization, solidarity, cooperation. And once again, this cooperation extends through time and across species. As we hold hands with Boudicca, the witches, Tecumseh, Nat Turner, John Brown, Harriet Tubman, Lozen, Wesley Everest, Kartar Singh Saraba Gruel, Maud Gunn, Eugene Debs, Eric Musum, Sophie Scholl, Hannah Sinesh, Ken Sarawiwa, the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, polar bears, wolves, chimpanzees, salmon, tuna. Through all of my work, my hand is extended. Take it if you wish. Take the hands of all these others. Draw what strength you can from each of us and take up where each of us has left off. But make sure to take all these hands into only one of yours. You'll need to keep your other hand free to make a fist or to pick up a weapon, whether that weapon is pen, paintbrush, pistol, sabot, or whatever other weapon you will need in order to use your gifts in the service of your land base, in the service of stopping this culture from destroying life on Earth. The time for waiting is long since done. It is time to act. We are all supporting you and counting on you. The planet needs you. Not only words matter, but so do actions, and so do you.